Columbia University. Todd Wolfson, speaking to us from Philadelphia, president of the American Association of University Professors. And Mahmoud Khalil, Columbia University graduate, an activist who spent over 100 days in an ICE jail. He was sent to Jena, Louisiana. During that time, his wife, Dr. Noor Abdullah, gave birth to their first son, Dean. He was released on June 20th. This coming weekend, I'll be speaking at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco on Saturday and in Berkeley. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
WRHU, Hempstead Radio Hofstra University. 88.1 FM, WCWP Brookville LIU Post. 88.3 FM, WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University. 88.3 FM, WVCR Loudonville Siena College. 98.1 and 105.9 FM, WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
WRHU Hempstead, 89.5 Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, 88.3 WRCT, Pittsburgh. You're listening to the One World Radio Show. I'm your host, Cody Millar. Joining with me is Ricky Hubert. Joining us today from the UK is Gavin Bruce, Chief Executive of the International Animal Rescue. Gavin, thank you so much for joining us today.
That's a pleasure, Cody. Thanks for the intro.
Sir, I'd love to hear a little bit more about, for our listeners who may not be familiar with International Animal Rescue, what is it that you do and what can people learn about?
Yeah, so International Rescue, we've been around for about 30 years. We work on specific projects around the world, protecting wildlife from an animal welfare perspective, but also from a conservation perspective. So our first big international project was in India. There was a rather gruesome dancing bear trade, which people may be aware of, where bears are kept as sort of kept in captivity and danced by the side of the road for entertainment. This is a practice that had gone on for probably 500 years. And we worked with a local partner and the Indian government to try and stop this, because it's very brutal. The cubs are poached from the wild. They were kept in captivity. They had their teeth knocked out. They had a red hot poker put through their nose with a piece of rope to kind of make them dance. And really, they're not dancing. They're kind of really in pain. So we set up a project where we built some sanctuaries for the bears that were in captivity to go in. But most importantly, we worked with the communities that were dancing the bears so that if they surrendered their bear, they would get alternative livelihood training and also support for their families, so that the need for the bear for money disappeared. And actually, they ended up with a much better life, education for their children, and a much more stable income than they had with the bear. So it was a kind of win-win, really, because I guess these things have kind of gone out of fashion a bit. Overseas tourists were not so interested in this kind of stuff. So they weren't making very much money. They were eking out an existence, really, and the bears were in terrible suffering. So we set up this project, and we rescued 700 bears from the roadsides of India. They were moved into three different sanctuaries in Agra, Bangalore, and Bhopal. Thousands of people benefited from a retraining program and a sort of community development program. And now, you know, up until now, these bears are now living, you know, a much more comfortable life. But more importantly, it stopped the trade. So we started in 2002. We rescued the last dancing bear from the streets of India in 2009. And there are now no dancing bears in India. So it was we ended it by having a very holistic approach, working with government, working with local people, supporting the community, and giving good care for the bears for the rest of their life. So it was a welfare project, but also obviously now there's not that demand for bears being poached from the wild. So it's has a good conservation angle as well. So that was kind of where we started. Based on that experience, we worked in Indonesia, mainly starting off working with primates, particularly macaques, that were, again, really being used for, kept as pets or used for entertainment. And we set up a program to rescue the macaques, often surrendered or they were confiscated by the authorities, rehabilitate them into troops and then release them back into the wild. So slightly different from the bears, where, you know, the bears were so badly damaged physically and emotionally that they were never going to be viable to be released into the wild. We're now into a program where we can release these animals back into the wild. That grew into working with other primates like the slow loris, which, very cute looking animal, very, very popular in the illegal pet trade, smuggled all over Southeast Asia and beyond, but very rare, highly endangered. Again, working with the authorities, working with local people. We have a rehabilitation centre in Indonesia, working again with a local group, where we can kind of bring the animals in and wherever possible release them back into the wild. And it kind of moved us from an animal welfare approach to, once you start working with endangered wildlife, you really... There's a sort of conservation angle as well. So you've got to be always trying to address the root cause of the problem. Why are these animals needing rescuing in the first place? No one wants to rescue animals. We want to stop it from happening. So, you know, a lot of our work has been around raising awareness, education, trying to sort of change hearts and minds so that, you know, it's not cool to keep these animals as pets. And we've had a lot of success with that. A lot of these animals have disappeared from the market. We're seeing less of it based on these very intensive education awareness programs done locally with local people, schools, groups, etc. That work in Indonesia then sort of moved on to work with orangutans in Borneo. So the main issue with orangutans was less about the pet trade. It was more about habitat loss. There was quite a lot of deforestation, certainly a sort of decade ago or so, that a lot of the tree cover had been lost on the island over the previous sort of 30, 40 years. Obviously, you know, if you remove the habitat, you're going to impact the biodiversity that's living in there. And there was a lot of animals being displaced. You've got these sort of large apes coming out, you know, being displaced from the forest and sort of moving into sort of communities and causing problems where, you know, inevitably they're going to come into conflict. And what would often happen back then was, you know, if it was a mother and a baby, the mother would be killed, the baby might be taken in as a pet, but it was more opportunistic. We set up a program whereby we started to work with the communities, understand the conflict situation, work with them on that. And the infants, I mean, having a baby orangutan is quite cute, but they soon get pretty big and pretty impossible to sort of keep around, and they'd end up just chained up outside, you know, outside someone's house, because they're so powerful, these animals, they become quite dangerous. So we set up a program of rehabilitation, again built a rescue center in Borneo, brought in these infants that were being displaced, and it was really the sticking plaster. It was the how do we come up with a system where we can at least get these animals back into the wild, also have a team of people working on prevention. How, you know, how can we stop the rescuing? How can we work with communities, work with landowners to try and maintain the forest so that the need for the rescue starts to be mitigated? The thing with orangutans is they spend a long time. An infant orangutan spends 7 or 8 years with its mother in the wild. So if you take an infant in that's, you know, just a few months old, you're into a long rehabilitation process, because you, in a rescue centre, have now got to replicate all that learning that the infant would have had by living with its mum for 7 or 8 years. So it's a long haul. And over the last 3 or 4 years, you know, a lot of these infants that came in 10 years ago have now been rehabilitated and released back into the forest. And I'm pleased to say that they're going into safe areas, national parks, and they're doing really well. You know, they really have adapted well. They're completely independent, living in the forest. And we're actually seeing some of the females that have been released having babies in the wild. So it's a kind of an amazing story, having infants come in, spend all those years with us, learning, becoming independent, not becoming habituated, not becoming reliant on humans, and then being released, monitored, and then eventually having their own offspring in the wild. So we're repopulating a diminished population. So that's a really exciting program. And there's a huge amount of work going on with local communities, the people that live around the forests that, you know, have farms or other, you know, there's other land use. There's a big problem with fires across Asia, forest fires. And it's really working with people on more sustainable land use, more sustainable agriculture. It's beneficial for them, and it's beneficial for the nature. And I have this sort of thing I say, you know, if you invest in people, you invest in nature. Because, you know, most people aren't going out to destroy nature. They're just trying to make a living. And if you can support their farming, support their families, support their livelihoods, then actually the impact on nature is reduced. And there's a huge amount of community-led initiatives across Indonesia that we've worked on with a local team there that has been hugely, hugely beneficial. And we're seeing massive impact, massive reduction on encroachment, illegal logging, poaching, all the things that are detrimental. And we're seeing the livelihoods of the people involved improving, which is amazing. And it's sort of much more holistic approach to conservation than just going around rescuing stuff forever, because you never keep up with that.
And so, Gavin, you were saying about where you do work. How do you find these communities all over the world, wherever they may be, whether it is in Indonesia or Asia? How do you find the communities that you work in? How do you pick your causes, so to speak?
Yeah, it's been, I mean, to be honest with you, it's been, we've tended, rather than sort of go too wide and have a sort of scattergun approach, because there's hundreds and hundreds of groups we could work with and ways in which we could support different projects. But the way we've evolved, and it has really been an evolution, is really creating partnerships from the very beginning. So all the work we really do, we've not just sort of come in and provided some funding. You know, we've been there from the kind of inception of the idea. And it is really from a network of people. Obviously, you know, working in India, we sort of got to know groups working in Asia. We met a brilliant vet called Carmela Yana Sanchez, who is the CEO of the Indonesian organization, the ASAN, that we work with there. And we've really kind of, you know, it has gone from, you know, a relatively small program working with macaques, and just by sort of doing a good job and building up a level of trust both with the government and with the communities, rather than go off and try and do something else somewhere else, it's that program has become established as the people that work with primates, work on the pet trade. And it's quite a systematic approach that's gone on. You know, it's a 20-year relationship now that's gone from, as I say, rescuing a few macaques at the beginning to now having rescued thousands and released thousands of animals, building these long-term relationships with the communities within which we work, and building a big team. Probably got 400 people in Indonesia now that are working on, you know, everything from physically looking after the animals that are either in our rehabilitation program that hopefully will be released one day, or there are always some animals that are never going to be released for you know, whatever reason. So the somewhat sanctuary animals, as we call them. But a team working on the awareness, a team working on sort of illegal wildlife trade and the enforcement and law, you know, law enforcement and investigations, a teamwork. Yeah, no, it's a big team of people, but it's very cross-functional. It's, you know, everything from people sort of sitting alongside facilitators working in the community, you know, working alongside the community, all local people. You know, it's unlike some organizations send a load of foreigners over to try and tell everybody what to do. It's not like that at all. Everybody there is I don't just mean from Indonesia, for example, they're from those communities that are working, that understand the kind of pressures and the hot, you know, what are the stress points that we could maybe help with some training on, something as simple as organic farming. I mean, I went to a farm a couple of years ago, and we'd done some organic farming training and had done a demonstration plot and split a paddy field down the middle, and by supporting the family and with this project, you could see, I was there for, it was kind of like the harvest festival for the rice, and you can see that the area that had had the organic farming approach compared to what they were doing before, the yield was twice as much. So now you've got a family that, instead of just about surviving and growing enough rice for their family, they've now got rice they can sell in the market. It means there's less pressure on them to then go off and do other, you know, hunting and having to use more land, which encroaches into the forest. And so it's a really supportive sort of community-based approach. There's a fabulous project called Power of Mama, which is, it's a bunch of ladies from the communities in Indonesia that are supporting fire prevention. And these are mothers, grandmothers. They've got a uniform. It's a fabulous female empowerment project. It's all females. And they literally go around the farming communities, making sure that the guys farming aren't doing slash and burn. They're not burning the crops, and which can be it's all deep peat there. So it's very risky from a wildfire perspective. But these are the women from these communities. They're the women that have seen the forest fires. They've seen the impact it has on their kids' health. They've seen the impact it has on the wildlife. They've seen the impact it has on the forest and the farms. And we're kind of just providing the facilitation for this amazing group of people, and they're quite formidable. They're riding around, you know, beating up the guys, telling them to stop, you know, burning stuff and giving them a hard time when they don't behave themselves. And it's gone from a few ladies to 100 strong now, and they've got a uniform, and it's completely voluntary, but it's just that sort of embedding these sort of environmental sort of priorities into day-to-day life. And a lot of work, obviously a lot of work with the kids, you know, conservation camps, education, providing education. You know, we have an after schools program where the kids can come along and learn other skills, learn English, learn computing, just giving them access to life skills that they just wouldn't have from their day-to-day schooling. So it's a very broad, very holistic approach. So going back to your question about how do we choose, it's more about depth, and it's about developing these things from almost the beginning to a proper holistic solution where you can really measure impact for both people, nature, and the environment over time. And we'd rather then scale that up than then go off and do something completely different somewhere else.
So, Gavin, I wanted to know, you know, for example, we know that with organization, we've seen it with, as soon as Trump administration came through, all of a sudden, there was a cut of funding. You know, did it affect you as an organization, since you guys deal internationally? Or it was one of those things like you would have to get funded because of the beautiful work that you guys are doing?
It's a really, really good question. Thank you. All of our funding comes from, there is some sort of government-to-government funding. So there was some money coming in from USAID and some of the people like US Fish and Wildlife and some of the divisions in the US government. I mean, obviously that has changed. Vast majority of our funding comes from either private trusts and foundations or individual giving. You know, it's, I mean, particularly at this end and in the US, you know, it's money coming in from individuals, whether it's adopting an animal on our website or it's a, you know, more philanthropic kind of relationship. There's a real mix. So we have quite a broad mix of income, but across the piece, obviously, you know, there was significant funding coming into some of the countries where we work from some of these international development programs, including the US, which, you know, that obviously has changed. We have seen an impact, and it has had an impact on some of the projects we were running. And it's not just the US. You know, there are other. The UK's changed its international development approach as well. So it's quite challenging because obviously some of these. The reality is, you know, you've got developing countries that are doing they're trying to do the right thing. You know, they're trying, you know, in the West, we developed the way we developed 100 years ago. And the economy was looked very different to how it looks now. What we know looks very different. You know, what we know now, we didn't know then. And if we want to help these countries develop in a way that's more sustainable, then there's almost like a subsidy, isn't there? It's kind of, you know, if it's bad for the planet to chop down all the rainforests, which it no doubt is from a climate change or biodiversity impact, for some of these countries, a kind of source of their GDP, whether it's timber or agriculture or mining or whatever it is that they're using the land for. So if we don't want to do that, there's a kind of equation where you've got to support them to do it in a different way that is beneficial to the sort of wider global environmental agenda. But, you know, obviously that was happening. That agenda has shifted a little bit. So, you know, we're just adapting with it. I mean, we're very much, you know, we're not a big policy making organization. For us, it's very much grassroots projects, because for our, you know, we believe that if you start with the people on the ground that are living in this environment, whether it's the guys dancing the bears in India, the people keeping animals as pets, the farmers that are sort of encroaching in the forest, you know, whoever it is, if you can invest in them, support them, understand their pressures, you know, you can sort of create a tangible benefit for them and for nature and the environment. But yeah, I mean, clearly there has been an impact of the way funding is. We haven't kind of seen it shake out yet fully, but some of those taps have certainly been turned off.
I'm curious also, Gavin, like with the way that different governments are responding to the climate crisis, how that also in your conservation work, making sure that, hey, if we are taking these animals out of captivity, that there's actually habitats for them to return to. What has that kind of been over the past few years?
Yeah, no, I mean, I sort of, it's interesting. I've been to some of the COP conferences, and particularly the biodiversity conference and the global biodiversity framework that was sort of signed off in at COP15, which was in Montreal a few years ago. And it kind of struck me a little bit that these things are still talked about as separate things. You know, they're talked about as an issue with biodiversity. And then there's obviously the big COP climate agenda with the Paris Accord and all the various annual meetings that go on, and you talk about climate change, and then you've got sort of big global health discussions around pandemics, which sort of really comes from the sort of World Health Organization. And for me, these things are just all linked together, because the biggest threat to biodiversity is climate change. One of the biggest mitigators for climate change is our nature-based solutions, you know, forest, peatlands, oceans. These are the biggest sinks of carbon, and if we can kind of protect those, then actually we go a long way to mitigating climate change. And our relationship with nature has a direct relationship with the health of humanity. So spillover of pathogens, as we've seen with the famous pandemic, but all the other sort of nasty pathogens that end up in the sort of human interface, it's really that sort of a sort of lack of respect of how these complex systems work. And if you kind of mess with nature, we kind of bites back a little bit. And I don't mean that in a flippant way. It's kind of, these pathogens exist in the wild and in a natural state, and the wildlife is evolutionary designed to cope with it. But then, of course, when we remove habitat and animals start to move, it's well documented, this spillover. The more interfaces you get between humans and farming, livestock, etc., and sort of nature, you run the risk of pathogens spilling over. So it's not sensationalizing it, it's just kind of common sense that for the sake of sort of human well-being, you know, and if it's, even if I'm being completely selfish and it's all about me and maybe my kids, then protecting biodiversity and having a healthy respect for nature, and then the benefits that has for the climate, it just kind of makes sense to me. And that's kind of the way I think of it, that these are these three things, human health, biodiversity and climate change, are totally interconnected, and they're all sort of different dimensions of the same issue. And it's sort of just trying to move to a slightly more sustainable way of living.
And with that, Gavin, you set us up excellent for the rest of this interview, because something you were saying before on your trip about the educational resources. This is, although it's the International Animal Rescue, involves animals and the environment and things of that nature, this is very much a people-powered movement. And you mentioned in the beginning, your whole goal is to change hearts and minds and to get people on board. And your education, there's educational resources on your website. How do you get the naysayers who might not necessarily see your point of view to get on the bandwagon of the great work that you're doing with the International Animal Rescue?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the debate comes around the causes, doesn't it? I think people are, most people, love animals. We have our pets, we have our sort of relationship. We have a relationship with animals. It might be different animals in different parts of the world. It might be the wildlife. It might be the birds singing in the tree. So I think as a human race, we have a sort of bond with animals. So it's then just trying to sort of link up that actually it's not so hard. We're not asking people to change their lives. We're just asking people to think a little bit about their relationship with animals and nature, and by sort of using the animals that people can, we do a lot of work with bears, but they're quite big, vicious animals. But I think because we all are given a teddy bear as a baby, people love them. It's kind of it's trying to find ways to get people to engage more with wildlife, animals, nature, and just to stop and think. There's a lot of issues with social media, for example, about exploitative videos with animals and wildlife. And we had a campaign a few years ago called Tickling is Torture, which were these people that had slow lorises as pets, and when you kind of touch them, they put their arms up in the air and it looks like they're being tickled, and it's all, and actually they're really highly stressed and, not having a great time. And it's easy, if you don't know, just to look at that and laugh and like it or share it or whatever, and it's kind of perpetuates this sort of the problem. And the social media companies have got a lot on their plate, and they never, we're always unhappy, aren't we, that they're not doing enough. I think we have to sort of take that responsibility as individuals and sort of say, what's okay and what's not okay, and learn a bit more about it. But I think by using the sort of animal, our relationship, that's almost like a primal relationship that we have with animals and wildlife, that we can just take that to the next stage and say, you don't have to change everything about what you're doing. It's just to stop and think. And if you're going on holiday and, you see a situation that you think, well, that animal is probably in terrible conditions in that nasty zoo, or it's being asked to perform for you, is that really right? Is that the way it should be living? And it's just, so that's really the way we're in Indonesia. It was really interesting with the slow lorises. People didn't really know it was elite. These were rare endangered animals that were being sold in the markets. And actually, when they found out, they're not people that are, deliberately going out trying to traffic wildlife. They just wanted a pet for their kids. And when you sort of said, actually, these are nocturnal primates, they're actually the only venomous primate, which is really unusual, they don't really make great pets. They're kind of like, oh yeah, okay, sorry, I didn't realize. And they're happy. And they're sort of almost like, well, can you take it then? I don't want it if it's like that. So it's just raising awareness, not preach. We don't go around preaching to anybody about anything. It's just kind of just giving people information, and then hopefully the word kind of spreads.
Something else, when we were first putting the show back together, you and I, Gavin, and with Kusi and Cody, something else you were mentioning, because we've talked about your projects all over the world. I don't think we've touched on your work with Costa Rica this summer with the howler monkeys. Talk a little bit about that. And then if you could tie that into this whole concept you've given us of how that it impacts humans and the environment, how it all goes together with a project like this, just so people can put it in perspective.
Yeah, for sure. So, sorry, I can't believe I missed Costa Rica. I'm going there next week, so it should be top of my mind. So Costa Rica, a project we've been involved with for coming up for about 7 or 8 years now. So the issue there is a little bit different. I mean, everybody knows Costa Rica. It's a very sort of biodiverse, beautiful country. A lot of people go there to enjoy nature. And they've done an amazing job of regreening a lot of the country. They've got a lot of national parks, and it is spectacular as a country. Rich in biodiversity, fabulous wildlife. And the problem we have, and of course that comes at a price, because it's become more popular, more people want to go, so you need more holiday homes, more hotels, etc. And we were started working with a very small group on the Pacific West Coast, and where these little coastal communities are being sort of developed for tourism, we were finding that obviously there's a lot of the wildlife has kind of moved in, and where everything's been regreened, and where the electric cables are being put into properties and hotels and supporting the infrastructure that's being built. In our case, howler monkeys. In other parts of the country, other tree living animals like sloths were being electrocuted on the electric cables. Teamed up with this group that had started a small project, really leveraging our experience, vet primate experience in Indonesia, to offer some support, and subsequently we've sort of taken on the project in full. I mean, we've developed a rescue centre, so there's somewhere for these animals to come in. I mean, a lot of them don't make it. It's high voltage electricity. What we sometimes find is that if there's a mother carrying a baby, the mother will be electrocuted and killed, but the baby is slightly insulated by the fur of the mother. So the baby, therefore, can, depending on how the electricity flows through, is either injured seriously or it is something that can be recovered from. So we've got a rehabilitation program, really, which is very intensive care at the beginning. They're very delicate, and much more delicate than orangutans that are remarkably robust. These little tiny howler monkeys are, you know, can be literally anything from a few days old, and we work with them, develop them into small troops over a few years, get them, you know, back up to strength. And the ones that can make it and get over the damage from the electrocutions, they then can be released as a troop, little troop, back into the wild. So that's kind of the thrust of the project. And then, of course, because as I've always said, you know, we're trying to deal with the root cause of the problem, we're then working with the government and the electric companies to identify hotspots where animals are being electrocuted, so that those areas can be insulated. We can cut back the trees to stop the animals getting access to the cables, putting up rope bridges, and just trying to, so far it's been okay, but it's not been great. It's a bit reactive, and we've got a big campaign at the moment, really trying to put a bit more pressure onto the Ministry of Environment and the government to be a bit more proactive about it. So not to put uninsulated, unsafe equipment into rural areas or areas of forest, which are, you know, where they know there's wildlife and, you know, there's a risk it's going to be damaging, which actually is enshrined in the Indonesian law and constitution that wildlife should be protected. And this is a bit of an anomaly. And it's always, when you're talking to tourists who have seen this thing, you know, they're like, they're so shocked because they've come there to see the nature and, you know, this sort of green brand that Costa Rica has. And, you know, rightly so, you've got this sort of almost like a bit of a dirty secret with these animals being electrocuted. And it's thousands and thousands of animals a year. So again, short term is the rescue center trying to, you know, provide care and get these animals back into the wild, which is our sort of every animal matters. But long term, working with the government on solutions, trying to put in the systems and processes to stop animals being injured in the first place, which those things take a bit more time, yeah, because it's always about, you know, getting the budget and getting it to be one of the more important things for them to deal with. So yeah, we've got quite an intensive campaign and some legal action going on at the moment to try and force a bit of action from that side of things. But it's a fascinating rescue centre. Most of our other places around the world are kind of either one, two or three species. I think our rescue centre in a year and a half we built a new rescue centre that opened the beginning of 2024. We had a temporary facility before that. And I think we're up to 140 species that have come through, everything from snakes to sea turtles to big cats. Obviously, we've had all the different primates through, spider monkeys, howler monkeys, you know, it's lots of birds. Again, pet trade, we've got macaws coming in that have been kept as pets. So working with the forest, sort of like the forest police that confiscate animals that shouldn't be being kept as pets, we're sort of good relationship with them. So it's, it's kind of a fascinating project. And that's just gives you an idea of the sort of biodiversity of the country. It's just with the volume and the sheer diversity of animals that come through the rescue centre. It's a busy, busy little setup.
So, Gavin, I know that we ran out of time. So quickly, people want to read more regarding the organization and also the initiatives that you guys are busy with or updated projects that you guys are also busy with. How can they get a hold of you?
Absolutely, yeah. So as I said, we're completely reliant on support from the public. So really appreciate this opportunity. Take a look at our website, which is internationalanimalrescue.org. Just search for International Rescue on the search engine and you'll find us. There's lots of ways to get involved and support us in different ways. Reach out. As I say, we can only do what we do. Really our only constraint is the amount of funding that we have available. And we are, grateful for any support, and all the programs we're working on are scalable. So it's really, we've kind of proved the concept. It's, we can do more with more support. So as I say, internationalanimalrescue.org, take a look. All the things I've talked about, you'll find information there. You can follow us on all the usual social media channels, and it'd be great to have people following us and learning more about our work.
Before we go, there was something we were talking about before we got on the air, and I think it's worth noting. There's something that you guys do that's a One Health approach that I think is really important to leave with, because it kind of ties up everything we were discussing. It's humans, it's the environment, and it's animals, and how it all kind of works together with the work you do, this holistic approach. Before we go, if you could describe that to the audience, I think that'd be very impactful to leave it on.
Thanks, Ricky. Yeah, so the holistic approach, it can be encapsulated in what we call a One Health approach. So it takes the view that the health of people, the health of animals, and the health of the environment are all interconnected. And by supporting and investing in people, you are investing in nature, and by investing in nature, you're investing in the environment, and by investing in the environment, you're supporting people. So it's kind of like a circular approach. And if you look at the problem in the round, then the impact is so much stronger, because if you approach a problem very much, I think in the past conservation has been done to people. You know, it's kind of big organizations that sit in big offices and come up with great ideas, and it all seems fine on paper, but things haven't gone so well. You know, we've seen lots of animals facing extinction, lots of habitats threatened and habitats lost. So Whereas we're kind of approaching it the other way around, approaching it from the ground up, understanding almost at the village level, almost at the individual level, what the pressure is. And by adopting this sort of One Health, you know, addressing educational needs, health needs, well-being and livelihood needs of a community, it then means that they are empowered to support the environment that they live in and around, especially in, when you're working with these, you know, communities that live in and around the habitats that you're trying to protect. So it's really just trying to adopt that interconnected approach between environment, people and nature at its sort of grassroots level. And, you know, in the last, I suppose, 10 years while we've been developing this, you know, we really have seen the impact and the stats, you know, the numbers. For example, you know, back when we first started rescuing orangutans in Borneo, we were, you know, we rescued hundreds in the first few years. In the last couple of years, we've rescued a handful because all the time and effort is spent working with the communities rather than having to rescue stuff. It's that sort of cause and effect approach. So that's, if you take the markets as another great example, the, you know, we've, if you just go into the markets and tell people to stop trading wildlife, they're just going to kick you out, and, you know, there's a lot of organized crime involved and it's all a bit dangerous. But if you talk to the people in the markets about actually their health, and obviously this is a bit more pertinent since the pandemic, where people are a bit more aware of spillover from wildlife, and keeping animals in these markets is, you know, maybe quite risky and dangerous and not good for human health. It, you know, they kind of see it a bit differently. They think, oh, actually, yeah, I kind of know what happened there, and I can, you know, maybe keeping a civet cat on top of a cage of bats, on top of a cage of lorises, I can see how that might be a problem, you know, as pathogens spread between different species and ultimately people. So it's kind of coming at it from a health perspective, but the health of people, the health of the environment, and the health of wildlife, and that kind of encapsulates the thinking. I hope that helps kind of explain it.
It does. I just thought it was good to note, because you are a One Health approach as you connect people throughout the world, and we are One World Radio, which brings people like you to the forefront through the power of radio around the world. So I just thought that was a really cool way to tie things together.
I would like to say thank you, you know, for all the communities out there in the world, for the beautiful work that you're doing for the community. But anyway, thank you very much, Gavin, for the beautiful work that you're doing for the community. And also, I wanted to know, I know that you said you would love one day to have an organization open in Africa. Are you thinking that, or is just the thought just came just now while we're doing this interview?
Well, no, I mean, we've got a lot on our plates at the moment. Maybe never say never is all I would say. I'd love to. I'm sure there's loads of great groups doing amazing work in Africa, and maybe one day in the future we can team up with a local group there. But maybe in the medium term. But right, you know, as I say, right now it's, you know, I think you alluded to it earlier. There's the pressure of funding and fundraising with cost of living and some of the funding channels being cut off. You know, we're having to be a little bit careful what we take on at the moment. You know, people are feeling the pinch, and we appreciate that. That means we're having to work harder to get the funding. So, but maybe one day it would be great.
And on that note, Gavin, we thank you very much for coming on our show today. You've been listening to the One World Radio Show on 88.7 FM WRHU, Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York, 88.3 WRCT in Pittsburgh, and Bush Radio Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to One World Radio, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, Hempstead, New York. We thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next week as we celebrate the power of radio in our one world. Tot ziens, jylle.
Tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makhwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
Me say I owe 40. Damn. Midweek, I radio for 40 hours. Depression showers feeling like, I'm E40. 21 days to form a habit, broken six. What? Problem is, these counterfeits like where you is. On the bottom, oh my God, I'm trust a kid like men with limp wrists. I know these niggas gon' switch. This your wake up call, you overslept again. Feeling trapped, bow tie on a double chin. Attitude is crap, you'll feel you'll never win. Off that, run it back and do it all again. Work in progress, but no promises. Even though my mindset aligns with all the derogatives, it's hard to be a good person when the world's hurting. Far from my first version, I'ma keep working, elevate.
Spaceship and take a flight. Escape the shoes with them old ass school middle rules. Only fool with Muslim, I'm cool with. Young crew, chopping like.
like kung fu, the tongue is a gun, my mind spraying late, strategy like Sun Tzu, people respect power, so I become it, ever since a child I want it, about 100,000 pounds of hundreds, life of poverty gotta be obsolete, of modesty I'ma be Black Bezos' prophecy, been shedding tears, I'm determined to turn his fear into money concerns, appear in the sun sipping German beers, get rich or die trying, my eyes been on that prize since I was 5 and since 9, I've been climbing, so watch me elevate and escape to a state of bliss from slave wages, it's time to rage against this machine. By any means, seems like a sunny day. Even though it's raining outside, 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 outside. I'm about to elevate. Say goodbye to the whole we die. We die, we die, we die. Seems like a sunny day. Even though it's raining outside, 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 outside.
WRHU Hempstead, Radio Hofstra University, 89.5 Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh, Radio Carnegie Tech. You're listening to the One World Radio Show. I'm your host, Cody Millar. Joined with me is Ricky Huber out of New York. And we're joined by lead of We Are Band Nerds, Brandon Cross. Brandon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Brandon, where are you broadcasting from right now? Cody's in Philly. I'm in New York. Where are you?
Broadcasting live from Dallas, Texas.
Dallas, Texas, the epicenter of We Are Band Nerds.
Yes, pretty much. D-Town, what's going on, everybody?
What's going on? I love it. So let's get to the million-dollar question. What is We Are Band Nerds?
Oh, that's a million-dollar question? Okay. We Are Band Nerds. We are a six-piece new metal collective. Yeah, we've been rocking for like 10 years, but we like to consider ourselves the blue-collar, working man's band, you know? So a lot of our content is, you know, based off of, you know, just your regular 9-to-5 person. You know, you have your celebrities and stuff like that, but then what about the regular 9-to-5 person that has dreams and aspirations just as well, you know? So that's what We Are Band Nerds is about. Pro-life, we're about positivity. We speak on depression and, you know, the things that we want in life and want to achieve and the obstacles that get in the way, and speak a lot on mental health, but we always encourage, you know, to keep pushing. So that is We Are Band Nerds in a nutshell.
Now, you and your other bandmates all kind of come from a musical background. Is that right? What kind of got you into music?
What brought me into music? I come from a musical family. I had older cousins that were in band and stuff, and they just made it look so cool, you know, growing up. And so I just kind of followed suit and picked the instrument and, you know, got involved with music early. You know, my first instrument, I was in third grade. I started playing the drums. And then once I moved to fourth and fifth grade, I started playing the trumpet. And all through high school, I played the trumpet and marching band and stuff like that. And so I met the other members, so to speak. Band Nerds really became a thing when I got to college. By then, I was already making like beats and stuff like that. It started as like a production company. So it was just a bunch of beats and, you know, songs getting written. But like, I didn't consider myself an artist. So I met Tony Lucas. He's the other front man of We Are Band Nerds. And you know, we were working together at this electric company called Encore, and he was like my trainer. And so we just vibed and, you know, we started rapping and freestyling together. And, you know, and he told me he made music and beats and stuff. And so we just started collabing and it became a, you know, kind of like a partnership. And one of my school projects while I was in college was they wanted us to showcase, you know, what we've been working on. I went to this music school, Media Tech. It was like an audio engineering school or whatnot. And so one of the final projects, you have to show what you've been working on. So we put together a band, and that was like the first thing of Band Nerds. You know, it was just to showcase our music that we've been working on. And it was kind of like the roots. There was no rock, you know, aesthetic to it at first. And we liked how it sounded. It went really well. We did well. I got a great grade, so to speak. And then me and him just started talking and was like, we should actually make this a thing, like make a band. And so that's how it began.
And so it started just you and your friend. It started as a partnership that way?
Yeah, it started as we were just making beats. We had no intention of being artists, so to speak. It just evolved.
So how does that evolve? Because we've all done things with projects and stuff, especially us, people like Cody, myself, who went to school for communications. You start with a class project or something, you do a story or something, make a little short film, and then you go, oh, there might be something here, and you try to grow it. And I see people have like different partnerships. How'd you guys grow it and evolve from that making beats and that school project to what it is today?
Oh, good question. I would have to say it was several ingredients that had to come into play that really helped us. But I would have to say both of our passions for music and then consistency of constantly being around each other. Because like I said, he was my trainer at my job. So like I saw him every day. We were hanging out pretty much every day, except instead of talking about work, we were talking about music and, you know, and how we could make it better and just being consistent. When you're with someone that shares the same passion as you, you know, and over time just being consistent, you're going to come up with